When I stopped in to visit with Robin White, the superintendent at Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site, I had no idea that our conversation in her office would lead so quickly to tears. I had interviewed Miss White a couple years ago, and at the time we stayed on track, keeping the focus surrounding the September 1957 events at Little Rock Central High School and the subsequent lessons learned. On this visit, I decided on the spur of the moment to change the focus if she was amenable. I said, let's talk about lessons learned, but more importantly, lessons not learned in the intervening six decades. I had no idea that my entree would open the floodgates of her soul. The subsequent conversation quickly had tears running down Miss White's cheeks and mine too. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me in Miss White's office in Little Rock, Arkansas, as she shares her profound, powerful thoughts and feelings that she confessed are way too often regretfully stuffed and suppressed. Robin White.
Good morning. My name is Robin White. I'm the superintendent at Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site, a unit of the National Park Service, which was established in 1998. And it was established to commemorate school desegregation and the Little Rock Nine. 60 years ago, you had nine Afro-American students that had this ideology about equality and wanting to pursue an equal education. That was 60 years ago, and the struggle continues.
One would think that we would have made some progress since 1957, and one would think that a lot of things that happened in the 50s and before would have been history. And yet we see some of the endemic racism within society and communities still rising their ugly head.
There's a term that I call space occupants apology, whereas we're constantly apologizing for our existence. It seems like we need permission for our existence, people of color. And you look at how society prescribe, and I call it a society prescription, prescribe how we are supposed to perceive or see each other. We don't see each other in totality. We see each other by color, by economics, by class. We do not see each other in the eye of humanity. And with this come so many faults and struggles, whereas many of us want to stand in our convictions and just be ourselves and perceived as a human being, but we are labeled and put into boxes. And lately, sad to say that we have become a footnote. When you watch TV, you see the news, and all these senseless lives are taken. When you take a life, you're taking a generation. You're taking generations of what's to come. You're wiping that out. You're wiping out that seed. And you're looking at the news, and here you see another man lost his life, and it's basically a footnote. And that's what we have become. And we are better than that. We are supposed to be better than that. We're supposed to be bigger than that. Why? Why is my dark skin a sin? Why am I looked at as different? We're all different. That's the beauty of us. That is why we were created. All this difference is what make all of us so wonderful. But to the core of me, I should not be struggling to be accepted. I should not be struggling for someone to see me in my totality. And it is so painful. I don't think people understand what it means to get up every day. We can't take this skin off of us. This is who we are. I value myself, and I know my worth, but others don't see that. They don't see my worth. They don't value me. We don't value each other. And with that, we are doing a disservice to each other. We are doing a disservice to the next generation, to our children, because they see that. How can we ready them? How can we prepare them to make decisions for our future when we are making all these bad decisions ourselves?
It seems to me that that explains so much for that momentum and that reason for Black Lives Matter, exactly what you're talking about.
People say all lives matter, and they do. But when you are losing a life every day, back to back, my brothers and sisters are just dropping. There's something wrong when people don't see. This has been going on since we've been here. The only difference now is that we have social media, that it's in real time. And no one would have believed it if we did not have social media. We would be perceived as liars, basically, that we're making this up. And still people, some people are still in denial. They could see it, but it's, sometimes it's just too much for them to wrap their head around, and they continue to deny it. We need a voice, yes. So when Black Lives Matter come into existence, there is a purpose. There is a purpose when we are looking to stand in our convictions. There's something that I believe in. Not only do I have a purpose, but we also must live on purpose. And we can't live on purpose if our lives are continually snuffed out. We can't live on purpose and make a difference if we are dropping like flies and no one is held accountable, or no one can see what's really going on because they are too blind, or they are just in denial because it's just too much. Black Lives Matter exists for a reason, and we need that. We need the support. We need the support of people that are not of color. We need people, just like during the movement, you had people from all across the nation, different denominations, right, ethnicities, everyone came together. We need that same support to overcome this. This hump, this is a big hump to overcome this. And we're not saying that all policemen are bad, but in every group, there is going to be a bad core. There is going to be a bad apple. And the only way to flush it out is for those, his colleagues, to step up and stand up and say, you do not represent me. You know, in the National Park Service, we wear our uniform with pride, the green and gray. We wear it with pride. And we have over 400 units, whereas we represent the story of a people. We're here to protect and preserve our natural resources. The same thing is that police officers are here to protect and preserve. You can't protect me if you fear me. You can't protect me if you are afraid. If you are afraid of me, and I can't see you, if I'm afraid of you, all I see is fear. And I fear for our children. I fear for my people. And this is heavy, very heavy on my heart. But not only my heart, all of us, We're all carrying this weight, and we should not have to. This belongs to all of us, and we all have a responsibility to each other.
What is your best feeling and idea for going forward, for exactly what you're talking about, for your children, for the future? How do we rise? How do we grow?
I think first, some of us have to admit that we're dealing with manufactured fear. A lot of this is synthetic fear. And this manufactured fear can no longer be justifiable to take a life. You cannot use this as an excuse to take a life. How can we see each other in totality if we fear each other? We have to have conversations. I think one of the greatest things that we can do is actually not only have training on sensitivity in our communities with law enforcement, but also with our residents. All of us need to be exposed to the struggle of a people and looking at civil rights. I don't think it should be one side. It needs to be both sides for us to understand each other. We need to come to that medium where as we could have conversations. You can't continue to fear me. We have to develop some respect for each other or with each other to move forward. We can't keep using excuses. I think that once upon a time, we knew who our police officers were. They knew our families in the community knew each other. And the policemen were part of our family. That no longer exists. They're not part of our family. And you have this code, this culture. Well, we all have a culture. And if we could find a way to break down some of those social and culture barriers, we could cross those thresholds and see each other and respect each other and work together. The communities belong to all of us. Like even as a park ranger or as a superintendent, my job is to serve the community and learn what their needs are. How can I serve them if I don't have a relationship with them? How can I give them or develop programs that are relevant to them if I don't have a relationship with them? And it's the same thing. We have to work together and get to know each other to diminish those social and culture barriers.
You are actually doing that here. I saw your brochure on some of your presenters and whatnot to do that outreach and to have people from Black Lives Matter come here and talk. So this really is an important community center in a sense right here. Your National Park side.
It is very important because we belong to the community. Community raised me. And with community raising me, I'm here to serve the community. The National Park Service is a vessel for me to serve the community and provide a forum for people to tell their narratives. We don't own their stories. My job is to provide a venue, a forum for them to tell, for the residents to tell their story, to write their own narratives. That's my job. That's my responsibility. And with that, opening those doors, more doors open. And we're making that connection, whereas it's a shame, and we're linked, 1, 2, 3, we're all working together. And that's what I see as being a servant and being a servant leader or being a servant to the community, for the community to tell me what they want and me to work with them to deliver what they want and making sure that it's relevant to them.
Robin, in your life, as you look back and you look forward, has there been progress sociologically, community-wise, that you've seen in your life, or has it been kind of a stasis?
Of course, there has been progress in different parts of the community, and even with me, I would say growing up with my parents were sharecroppers coming from a Mexican plantation in Slaughter, Mississippi. Growing up in the bayous, growing up in the low country. So I've always been of the earth. I've always been of the earth and connected to the earth as far as looking at where I come from. And so we all belong. It's the problem is many of us struggle to be accepted or to belong. If you don't know who you are, if you have no foundation, it makes it even harder. But yes, there has been tremendous progress, but that does not mean that we can't do better. We must do better.
Looking forward, looking to the future, what is your best hope and how do we rise to that next level?
Step by step. We have to own this, I don't want to say monster, but there is some darkness here. How can we move toward the light if we don't even admit or own that darkness that we're standing in, that we're sitting in, and then moving forward? We have to admit what is going on, own that, and then look at solutions. And it takes all of us. It can't be one person too. It takes all of us from the community. That means law enforcement. That means special services. That means social organizations, social justice organizations. All of us have to work together. The bad part about this is that...
In which ways are y'all working together now?
We have town hall gatherings right here at the Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site. We are having those conversations right here at Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site. We have the FBI, local FBI, that will come in and have conversations with the community. But they contacted us because this is what they want to do, and this is what they want to be a part of, solutions. Looking at how we can move forward. We've had conversations, a program called Conversations of Color, and talking about from Alabama, or Birmingham to today, and looking at our progress, where we were then and where we are now. We have to do it step by step, but it is so important to own it. We have to admit that there are some problems. We have to admit we're not perfect. And then come together to have that dialogue and looking for solutions. In November of last year, we had what we call a social conscious gathering where people from across the country, even from Northern Ireland came, all of us came together. And we were talking about religious divide. We were talking about economic inequality. We were talking about the education system and how it is going. We're regressing. It's becoming separate again. But not equal. And so we could talk about the problems, but we also must look at solutions. And it is our responsibility to go back into our communities. And so you had Dr. Habrowski, the president of Maryland University. You had Dr. Herschel from the Jewish community. You had rabbis. You had people from the Muslim community, Islamic. All of us came together. People that were connected to Bloody Sunday in Northern Ireland, all of us came together. We had youth from Philander Smith College, from Arkansas Baptist, and people came from as far as Boston. But all of us came together to talk about the here and now, the American Indian Movement. We had the American Indian Movement and the FBI in the same room. And we were talking about how we can move forward. But I don't have the answers. I don't have all the answers.
It sounds like that is your best hope and best answer for our communities, is conversations.
It is definitely conversation. And coming together in your communities and taking ownership of your communities. Because I can't go in your community and tell you how to solve your problems. Identify your problems and then how you can come together to move forward and looking for some resolve and solving it. And definitely youth must be at the table. Our children must be at the table. And we must teach them about this decision making, because they will be making decisions on our behalf in the future. So we must ready them. They see all of this craziness going on. And this summer I had a house full of youth right here at the site. Most of my employees were youth, and they were in so much pain. They were in so much pain that we had to come together and sit down and talk. We had to let them express themselves. And with that, I decided that we have to continue this conversation. We must. And so we're meeting. Yes, we'll have a conversation with Black Lives Matter, but most of this is actually launched by our youth as well. And of course, with journalism, but is launched by our youth as well. We have to give them that platform where they can express themselves and allow them that space and time to grow. But also we have to start that healing process, because they are in so much pain. If we are hurting, I know I'm hurting, then how is this impacting our children? And we have to take that into consideration.
Wow. Robin White, thank you so much. You've made my day once again. Absolute pleasure to be with you.
You're most welcome, and I appreciate it.
The underbid music was performed by the St. Mark Baptist Church Sanctuary Choir, recorded live in Little Rock, Arkansas. Before we go, let's take a step back in time to Central High School, Little Rock, Arkansas, 1957.
I know the Lord, will make a way.
September 4th, 1957. Summer vacation was over, and it was the first day of school in Little Rock, Arkansas. 9 black children attempted to start classes at the all-white Central High School, but their entry was blocked by hundreds of Arkansas National Guardsmen. They'd been sent out on direct orders issued by Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus to block the entry of the 9 students who will forever live on in history as the Little Rock 9.
Units of the National Guard have been and are now being mobilized with the mission to maintain or restore the peace and good order of this community.
President Eisenhower subsequently dispatched the 101st Airborne Division and placed the Arkansas National Guard under federal command.
Such an extreme situation has been created in Little Rock. This challenge must be met. The troops are there pursuant to law solely for the purpose of preventing interference with the orders of the court.
With bayonets fixed, more than 1,000 federal troops provided protection and escorted the 9 black students into the school as hundreds of taunting, rock-throwing white men and women venomously protested.
What about you, sir? Do you think the colored students will show up?
If I got anything to do with it, they won't show up. Well, I think it's a breaking point of the school integration. I just don't feel that they have a right to go to school.
The 9 were reluctantly allowed to attend classes, but not without endless harassment and abuse. And they were not allowed to attend any extracurricular affairs, proms, programs, or sports. Phyllis Brown, the little sister of Minnie Jean Brown, who was one of the Little Rock 9.
How old were you?
I was 9.
Do you remember what was going on?
I remember lots of stuff about it. I remember the terror. I remember how it had affected our household, our family, not only the Brown household, but how it affected the families of all of the nine, how they were all fractured and had to build itself back up, and how we were all sent away to live with relatives.
Your parents were fearful for your lives.
Yes, we were in a state of terror, you know. Right now, the world keeps using the word terrorist. But strangely, they didn't use the word terrorist during 1957. But it was terrorism.
When you think of your sister, do you remember her strength? What comes to your mind when you watch her going off to school?
I remember words. I remember pictures of her smiling, mm-hmm. in spite of the fact that she had been kicked or pushed down the stairs or hit. There are pictures of her smiling.
And isn't it just incredible to see that strength and that optimism and power in one individual?
It runs in our family.
I can tell.
Yeah. My father said to my mother in 1957, let that girl go to that school. Yeah, she can go to that school. And then to hear my mother say, she had to do it. You know, that tells me who I came from.
Your sister, did she complete high school?
She was expelled from Central.
Oh, really?
Yes, and you will hear her say, even currently, how bad it made her feel that she was expelled. But her expulsion was to her response to being terrorized.
She was attacked by some white girls. Tell us what happened with that.
Yes, daily attacks throughout the day, all kinds of attacks. And one day she responded. She was expelled.
What did she do then? How did she graduate from high school?
Oh, my gosh. She must have had some kind of guardian angel on her shoulder because she was invited to New York City to live with the famous doctors Kenneth and Mamie Clark, and she graduated from New Lincoln High School.
And then she went on to college. Tell us what she did with her life and her career.
She did go to college. She went to Southern Illinois University, met her husband, and went to Canada, and she forged a life as a Canadian.
Phyllis Brown, what a pleasure and honor to visit with you.
Central High School, Little Rock, Arkansas. Troops, which for nearly 3 weeks lined the sidewalk here in front of the high school under orders to keep the colored students out, have been replaced now. And their orders to comply with the law, which means let the Negro students in if they come in.
The events of September 1957 at Central High School was a seminal turning point in America's civil rights movement. And the lessons learned live on at Little Rock Central High School today. I'm Tom Wilmer.
Said he wouldn't make love.